We went to the women's restroom, each of us locked in separate stalls, weeping. We didn't exchange a word. Not because we felt so alone in our grief, but because we were so together in it, as if we were one body instead of two. I could feel my mother's weight leaning against the door, her hand slapping slowly against it, causing the entire frame of the bathroom stalls to shake. Later, we came out to wash our hands and faces, watching each other in the bright mirror. We were sent to the pharmacy to wait. I sat between my mother and Eddie in my green pantsuit, the green bow miraculously still in my hair. There was a big bald boy in an old man's lap. There was a woman who had an arm that swung wildly from the elbow. She held it stiffly with the other hand, trying to calm it. She waited. We waited. There was a beautiful dark-haired woman who sat in a wheelchair. She wore a purple hat and a handful of diamond rings. We could not take our eyes off her. She spoke in Spanish to the people gathered around her, her family and perhaps her husband. "Do you think she has cancer?" my mother whispered loudly to me. Eddie sat on my other side, but I could not look at him. If I looked at him, we would both crumble like dry crackers. I thought about my older sister Karen, and my younger brother Leif, about my husband Paul, and about my mother's parents and sister who lived 1,000 miles away. What they would say when they knew, how they would cry. My prayer was different now. A year, a year, a year. Those two words beat like a heart in my chest. That's how long my mother would live. "What are you thinking about?" I asked her. There was a song coming over the waiting room speakers, a song without words, but my mother knew the words anyway, and instead of answering my question, she sang them softly to me. "Paper roses, paper roses. Oh, how real those roses seemed to be," she sang. She put her hand on mine and said, "I used to listen to that song when I was young. It's funny to think of that, to think about listening to the same song now. I would have never known." My mother's name was called then. Her prescriptions were ready. "Go get them for me," she said. "Tell them who you are. Tell them you're my daughter." I was her daughter, but more. I was Karen Cheryl Leif. Karen Cheryl Leif. Karen Cheryl Leif. Our names blurred into one in my mother's mouth all my life. She'd whispered it and hollered it, hissed it and crooned it. We were her kids, her comrades, the end of her and the beginning. We took turns riding shotgun with her in the car. "Do I love you this much?" she'd ask, holding her hand 6 inches apart. "No," we'd say with sly smiles. "Do I love you this much?" she'd ask again. And on and on and on, each time moving her hands farther apart. But she would never get there, no matter how wide she stretched her arms. The amount that she loved us was beyond her reach. It could not be quantified or contained. It was the 10,000 named things in the Tao Te Ching's universe, and then 10,000 more. Her love was full-throated and all-encompassing and unadorned. Every day she blew through her entire reserve. She grew up an army brat and Catholic. She lived in 5 different states and 2 countries before she was 15. She loved horses and Hank Williams and had a best friend named Babs. 19 and pregnant, she married my father. 3 days later, he knocked her around the room. She left and came back, left and came back. She would not put up with it, but she did. He broke her nose. He broke her dishes. He skinned her knees, dragging her down a sidewalk in broad daylight by her hair. But he didn't break her. By 28, she managed to leave him for the last time. She was alone with Karen Cheryl Leif riding shotgun in her car. By then, we lived in a small town an hour outside of Minneapolis in a series of apartment complexes with deceptively upscale names, Mill Pond and Barbary Knoll, Tree Loft and Lake Grace Manor. She had one job, then another. She waited tables at a place called The Norseman, and then a place called Infinity, where her uniform was a black t-shirt that said, "Go for it," in rainbow glitter across her chest. She worked the day shift at a factory that manufactured plastic containers capable of holding highly corrosive chemicals and brought the rejects home, trays and boxes that had been cracked or clipped or misaligned in the machine. We made them into toys, beds for our dolls, ramps for our cars. She worked and worked and worked, and still we were poor. We received government cheese and powdered milk, food stamps and medical assistance cards, and free presents from do-gooders at Christmas time. We played tag and red light, green light, and charades by the apartment mailboxes that you could open only with a key, waiting for checks to arrive. "We aren't poor," my mother said again and again, "because we're rich in love."